From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Pierce Brosnan. He's starring in the hit summer movie The Thomas Crown Affair, which features him in some pretty steamy sex scenes with actress Renee Russo. The film is a remake of the original with Steve McQueen. Later this fall, Brosnan also stars in his third James Bond film, The World Is Not Enough. Coming up, we talk with him about acting, getting naked, and the challenge of taking on roles of other famous actors. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the HBO documentary Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, which premieres tonight. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Independent counsel Kenneth Starr said today that he's working to wrap up his investigation of the Clintons as quickly as possible. Sid Hoskinson reports from Peach State Public Radio in Atlanta.
Ken Starr told reporters in Atlanta today that he plans to finish his investigation of the Clintons before the 2000 elections. Mrs. Clinton is considering a Senate race in New York. Starr would not speculate about any prosecutions of either of the Clintons, nor would he give a possible date for the final report on his 5-year investigation. He did say, however, that his report will cover all aspects of the investigation, including the Clintons' Whitewater real estate dealings and the president's affair with Monica Lewinsky. Starr was in Atlanta to participate in a roundtable discussion at the annual meeting of the American Bar Association. For NPR News, I'm Sid Hoskinson in Atlanta.
The Clinton administration has rejected a complaint from independent American oil producers who charge that 4 countries are dumping oil at unfairly low prices on the U.S. market. The complaint came from comparatively small oil producers operating in Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, who united under the name Save Domestic Oil. They accuse Saudi Arabia, Mexico, Venezuela, and Iraq of hurting their business by selling oil to the U.S. at artificially low prices. A big chunk of the U.S. energy industry, including major oil companies and energy users, opposed the petition, saying the group didn't have the standing to file a complaint since it didn't represent a quarter of domestic oil production. If the Commerce Department were to find violations of the anti-dumping laws, it could have imposed punitive tariffs on about 60% of imported oil. Leaders of the main Serbian opposition groups met today in Belgrade with the head of the Serbian Orthodox Church. They agreed to join together for a mass anti-government rally next week. Sarah Chase reports from Belgrade.
One party head said he didn't want to make too much of a single meeting, but it was the first time several of the opposition leaders had sat down at the same table. Each stated his view of how a change in government should be brought about. The Synod of the Serbian Orthodox Church, which in the past has supported the policies of Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, called for his resignation in June. Today's meeting marks the stepped-up involvement of the church in opposition politics. Involvement that Democratic Party head Zoran Djindjic welcomed.
Only institution in Serbia with credibility among all majority of the people. It is of crucial importance for us to have support to church.
The Synod of Bishops meets tomorrow to decide official church policy on political affairs. Sarah Chase, NPR News. Belgrade.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 6 points to close at 10,707. This is NPR News. The U.S. Coast Guard has ordered the closing of the Ohio River near Henderson, Kentucky, following a barge accident. Dan Modlin of member station WKYU has this report.
Officials with the Kentucky Division of Emergency Management say several thousand gallons of fuel have been spilled into the river. The U.S. Coast Guard is sending a team of specialists to deal with the situation, and booms are being deployed in an attempt to divert the material. At least 2 barges collided, spilling gasoline today. The slick created by the spill is moving relatively slowly, in part because recent dry weather has reduced the flow of water in the Ohio River. Warrant Officer Bill McKenzie of the U.S. Coast Guard says it's unclear what caused the barges to collide. Environmental specialists are at the scene trying to evaluate the extent of the damage caused by the spill. Only emergency vessels are being allowed in the area, which is located between Henderson, Kentucky and Mount Vernon, Indiana. For NPR News, this is Dan Modlin in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
A Holocaust Insurance Claims Commission has come up with a formula under which European insurance companies would compensate the families of Jewish victims of Nazi Germany. Lawrence Eagleburger, the chairman of the commission, called for the companies to pay about 10 times the face value of Holocaust-era insurance policies. The formula is designed to cover inflation over the 6 decades since most such policies were issued, as well as interest. The German insurance firm Allianz issued a statement saying that some differences remain between the commission and the companies involved, and that it hoped they could be ironed out in meetings this month. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 6 points to close at 10,707. The Nasdaq lost 29 points to close at 2,519. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, in for Terry Gross. It's been 31 years since the movie The Thomas Crown Affair, a stylish thriller starring Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway, made its debut. Since that time, it's been on many people's favorite movie list. A remake of The Thomas Crown Affair with Rene Russo and Pierce Brosnan in the Dunaway-McQueen roles has just opened nationwide. In this version of the story, set in New York, Brosnan plays bored, self-made billionaire Thomas Crown, who steals a priceless Monet from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Russo is insurance company investigator Catherine Banning, who is sure that Crown masterminded the heist. She just needs the goods to prove it. Here's the scene where they first meet.
Who do you work for?
I'm in the art world.
Dealer?
Mm-mm.
Gallery owner?
No, it's closer to insurance.
I'm covered.
Not for this. The painting. The Monet. You don't think they'd simply cut a check for $100 million, do you?
So you...
get them things. When there's this much money involved, it usually means I get them someone's head.
And whose head are you after?
Yours. Good evening, Mr. Crown.
Several years ago, Pierce Brosnan took over another part made famous by someone else, the role of James Bond, a character closely associated with Sean Connery. Brosnan's third 007 movie, The World Is Not Enough, will be out this fall. He also stars in a forthcoming David Attenborough film, Grey Owl, in which he plays an American Indian. I spoke with Pierce Brosnan about the remaking of The Thomas Crown Affair. First, let's listen to the same scene from the original movie, where Dunaway's character first tells McQueen's Thomas Crown that she works in insurance.
I investigate.
Anything in particular?
A bank, Mr. Crown. The caper, sir. You don't expect us to take the loss of over $2 million lying down, do you?
It's an interesting picture. Pays well, though, huh?
Depends on the return.
Sort of an American-type headhunter.
You could put it that way, yes.
And whose head are you after?
Yours.
Mine?
Yours.
How much did you want to pay homage to Steve McQueen in your portrayal of that role?
Well, I wanted it to be respectful of who he was as an actor. I would have, if he was around today, I would like him to go to see the film and say, cool film, Pierce. You did a good job. And simple as that. The original was loved by many people. And interestingly enough, of course, you know, there are people who have never seen the original. And for McQueen, too, this was a departure, this particular role. He never got into suits, really, whereas I seem to have been born in suits.
Perhaps trying to get out of a suit, right?
Perhaps trying to get out of a suit. I don't have any problem with it. Other people might seem to have a problem with it or think that I have a problem with it, but I don't. But I know that there was trepidation for McQueen doing this role. He was quite nervous. And ironically, Norman Jewison wanted, guess who, for this role? He wanted Sean Connery. So, go figure. I didn't know that till I started making the movie. But I just thought the film was worthy of a remake. I thought we could get away with it, just like he gets away with what he gets away with, Thomas Crown. And I love the coolness of the character, the slickness of the character.
Is it risky making a remake in that you have a whole group of people who have seen the original and feel that you just can't touch it? And if you take liberties, you're going to ruin the film. And if you are too faithful to it, then it means you have no imagination.
Oh, yes, great risks. The greatest fear came before, 2 weeks before we started shooting. That was my greatest time of fear. I was confident in the sense that I kept going back to the text and the script, and I thought we'd... And once I had John McTiernan, like I say, I knew I had a movie, and as far as being a producer, one relinquishes all of that. He becomes the leader. He is the one who takes charge. And not that I didn't have a voice, but I was quite content to just let him,
run the show. Right.
Yeah,
and he's the director.
And he's somebody who I've worked with before. I did John McTiernan's first film. I was after the first season of Remington Steele, and I got my first American movie. And it was a thing called Nomads, and he directed it. And I could see then that he was this brilliant director. And it was just a great experience. I mean, this week of promoting the film has been quite wonderful, quite magical.
Have you ever been naked in a film before?
I was actually naked in his first film.
Oh, were you? many years ago, I guess.
Yes, many years ago. But I think it's still retained its shape and form. I tend to, look after myself. And I'm actually doing my exercises right now as we're talking, doing my butt exercises. It's very good, ladies and gentlemen.
But did you have any trepidations about being naked in a film?
No, not really. I've been naked on stage and in plays, and I was, I've done 3 films this year or last year, and the first film last year was with Richard Attenborough, a movie called Grey Owl, and I'm naked in that. It's just coincidence, really. I don't have a thing about being naked. It's just the way it falls. I don't have any problem with being naked.
Are there little tricks to doing naked love scenes? And I'm thinking of the love scenes between you and Rene Russo in this film. Any
tricks? Usually a good few belts of whiskey or champagne or whatever your poison is. I came knocking on her trailer door with some champagne and she wasn't having any of it, so I drank it myself.
You didn't have to woo her, right?
I was the one who was drunk. No, there's not. You just kind of take courage in both hands and leap in there. And it's good if you like somebody, and I like Renee a lot. And I have a great fondness for her. And I think she is spectacular in this movie. And I think and hope and wish that it will just, be glorious for her career ahead.
Right.
It's bloody silly. I mean, 2 grown people standing there in G-strings, these little G-strings. And actually, mine was quite a big G-string. But, it was, it's written on the page, too. They make love. They do the wild thing.
Right.
So that's all the writer writes.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're in the hands of the director. And luckily for us, the hands of a very visual and stylistic and articulate director. So, she and I, Renee and I, were standing there in our bathrobes, and the first sequence, the start of the lovemaking sequence, was on the pool table. Uh-huh, okay, and there's all this matting around the pool table. And I thought it was all just going to be right there. And he said, no, just this is you on top of the pool table, and I just want you both to kind of be laughing and roll off. And you're standing there in G-strings, and you don't know where to put your hands, and you put them on your hip, and you look like some kind of, hello, it's Thaler. And so you kind of put them in front, and you think you're being, shy of what you've got. So you kind of stand with them down beside your waist, and you You feel rather silly, in other words. There's no tricks, really.
You just have to do it, right?
You just
have to trust the director and the person you're with.
Just trust the director and try to make it as... In this particular case, it's a fun love scene. You know, it's sexy and it's sensuous and it's erotic, one hopes, but it's also fun, and sex should be fun.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to take a short break, but then I want to talk some more with you about your work in films. And our guest today is Pierce Brosnan. He stars in the new film. It's a remake of a 1968 film called The Thomas Crown Affair. And later on this year, The World Is Not Enough is coming out. That's the latest James Bond film. Then he's got another film with Richard Attenborough coming out this fall as well, called Grey Owl. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Pierce Brosnan is our guest today on Fresh Air. We're talking about a new film he's just made. It's a remake of The Thomas Crown Affair. It stars Pierce Brosnan and Renee Russo. Well, I know that later on this year, your third installment of the James Bond films is coming out, The World Is Not Enough. Did you have trepidations playing 007, of course, after Sean Connery and Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton?
Yes.
Sure. How so?
I would have been a foolish man if I didn't have trepidation. You have to respect the role first and foremost. It's not one of these kind of as light as it is in many areas. You know, you have to respect it, and I did, and I do. But there was a long way to fall if I screwed it up. I mean, I had nothing to lose. I didn't have a movie career per se. I had a healthy body of work, but I didn't want to be the man who put the final nail in the coffin of Bond. So for Martin Campbell, who directed the movie, and for myself, and for everyone involved, but certainly for the two of us, being the most visible figures on the landscape, there was, again, great risk and fear. There's a lot of fear in acting, actually. It's one of the great joys of it, believe it or not. It can be a rather sensuous feeling, or it can be just mind-numbing and body-numbing.
But the joy being overcoming the fear?
Facing the fear. Standing out on the stage. Mm. And I just knew it was doable. Again, I just... This is a movie that came into my life in 1986 after the demise of Remington Steele, but for one reason or another, and there are many, and I won't bore you with them, I couldn't do it in 1986.
Well, they wanted you for another season for Remington Steele, right?
Yes, they wanted to have their cake and eat it. It's greed. It's money. It was a very frustrating time for me, and I was angry and all of those emotions that go with being denied something which can change your life around and something which you wanted and then you were not allowed to do. So for it to come around a second time is really was extraordinary. I wasn't looking for it, nor was I waiting for it. But come around it did, and when all the meetings and the negotiations were over and the phone went on that particular day, August 94, and my agent said, okay, we're on. We're going to do Bond. I said, don't let there be any screw-ups. I just don't want to be led up the aisle again. And they said, no, it's not going to happen. And then once I knew it was on, then it was... That's the mission.
There's so many Bondisms, though. I mean, even if it's just that Bond, James Bond, that you have to master... And even when we hear it, it's at least initially it was Sean Connery's voice. Did you have to work on that line in particular?
You do find yourself saying it in the car. You do find yourself saying it as you brush your teeth. It's very difficult to say it when you're brushing your teeth. But yes, you do find yourself saying the name's Bond, James Bond. And how you say it, and the spacing of it, the name's Bond. Beat, 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 James Bond. I mean, oh, you can drive yourself nuts with it, really. And at the end of the day, you just say your name, say the character's name. But of course, theatrically, you have... You've gone through all these ramifications, and you try not to pick it. But, yes, I remember the day I said it on Goldeneye, actually, because we'd been doing the scene for about 2 days, and we were on Famke Janssen. Then they came round on me, and they were doing the close-up, and it was about 10 to 1, and lunch is at 1 o'clock, and movie crews, they like to have their lunch. If lunch is at 1, you break at 1. And it was 10 to 1, and we were doing my close-up, and I had to say this line. And it was a casino scene, and all the extras, about 300, were standing behind the camera.
Looking at you, right?
Looking, yeah. And I thought, do I say, can you clear my eye line? Which actors sometimes do. If you're concentrating on an actress or an actor beside the camera, you can say, can you clear my eye line, please? Just... But I didn't. I thought, no, damn it, I'm just going to stand here and say it. So we did 2 takes, and we had lunch. And then I went back to the dressing room and said the line over and over again in front of the mirror. I think, did I do it right? Did I do it right? No, I did it right. I did it right. So you obsess about these things. And the vodka martini shaken, not stirred.
Yeah, all those...
All of these signatures. Signature. So, yes, yeah. You do, but... You have fun with it as well, and that's one of the prerequisites, can never say that word, of playing this part. But you have to, and, you know, what Connery put down there 32 years ago is still kind of the blueprint for this role, it seems. But I'm certainly making a good go at it, getting up there and taking the belt off the Scotsman, God damn it. And that's what it is. It's get in the ring and take the belt. You know, it's a fight. And you go in there, you have your detractors, and people say, nah, Brosnan, yuck, no, Connery. And you have to have broad shoulders and live with that.
How many James Bonds are left, do you think?
Well, my contract is for 3 movies with the option of a 4th. And I've done 3. And now we just have to see who wants to take the option on the 4th.
And kind of see how the 3rd does, I guess, too.
Yes. I mean, I'm being coy here, really, because I'd like to do a 4th one, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I've had a good time doing them, and they pay well, so... Why not?
Do you ever want to play a role where you're not well-dressed and well-coiffed and debonair and suave and all that stuff?
Well, I have, actually. It's just that no one's ever seen those films that I've done.
Which one?
They've been and gone, oh, I did a movie years ago called Taffin. I did a wonderful film, actually, really wonderful film called Mr. Johnson. But I suppose I was playing a British officer in that. I was certainly tailored.
But you like being tailored, I get the feeling.
Yes, I do. I do, and I do feel there are other roles there. And they will come, they will be there, possibly, maybe. But I have a desire for other roles and a want and a need for other roles, but... You know, the last 5 years have really been a new beginning in many respects since the success of Bond in my life. And it's, you know, Thomas Crown is not a stretch by any leap of the imagination, and I know that, I'm fully aware of that, but that I have a great time doing it, yes. And for me, as a working actor, as a journeyman, this is the greatest joy, and to be working with the people that I work with and, you know, have another feather in my cap producing.
Well, I have to say that I really appreciated the fact that in the Thomas Crown Affair, the love affair between you and Rene Russo is a love affair between two adults, that she's not 22 years old. She's clearly a middle-aged woman.
Mm-hmm.
And rather nice to see on the screen, too.
A middle-aged man, a middle-aged woman.
Shocking, isn't it?
I guess. Is 46 middle-aged, Marty? Is it really?
I think it is.
Can't move the goalposts, please. People are living longer. We've got Viagra now and things like that. Well, I wanted to make a movie. I wanted to make an intelligent, sexy, mature movie about a man and a woman and be able to invest of myself some feelings of life and love. And this is a man who has everything in the world, wealth, riches. He moves through the fair of finance and the world of men and the cruelty and all of that strangeness of Wall Street. But is, you know, there's no woman in his life. There's no person there that makes him come alive until he does this job, this heist, just for the sheer fun of it. And there she is standing there. So I wanted to have a woman there and someone who, like Rene Russo, and luckily she said yes. And there's, you know, so few of these movies around. You see the guys out there and they're with younger girls and it's like, you know, it doesn't work. The audience don't buy it. And, you know, we've seen a few of the lads kind of stumble a little bit there. And, you know, not to say that, you know, I can stumble with the best of them. But we wanted a movie which was just, there was balance. There was
equality.
Equality. And I think we got it in spades with Rene Russo.
We'll talk more with Pierce Brosnan in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Fresh Air. And here's a clip from the 1995 James Bond film, GoldenEye.
Madame stands with five. Six. Madame loses.
Liatch. Enjoy it while it lasts.
The very words I live by. What words do you live by?
The trick is to quit while you're still hit.
That's one trick I've never learned. Perhaps you'll show me how it's done.
Thank you.
Vodka martini. Shaken, not stirred. And for you?
The same.
How do you take it?
Straight up. With a twist. Thank you, mister.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Xenia Sergeyevna Onatopp.
Onatopp?
Onatopp.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Life of Birds by David Attenborough, a companion to the 10-part TV series airing now on PBS, in bookstores or on the web at pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Pierce Brosnan. This fall, he stars in his third James Bond film. Currently, he can be seen in the summer hit The Thomas Crown Affair. And David Bianculli previews the new documentary on Lenny Bruce, which premieres on HBO tonight.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. My guest is actor Pierce Brosnan. He's starring in this summer's hit movie, the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair, with Brosnan and Rene Russo in the Steve McQueen, Faye Dunaway roles. Brosnan is also starring in a new James Bond flick due out this fall, The World Is Not Enough. This is Brosnan's third go at 007. And he's starring in an upcoming David Attenborough film, Grey Owl. When did you first become interested in acting?
I was a teenager. I was about 17. I'd left school at 15. I was good at art. I loved films. I loved movies. I loved the magic of them and the romance of them. And I was, as I say, a trainee commercial artist, and I was hanging my coat up one morning, and I was talking to a fellow colleague about movies, and we always talked about movies, and he said, you should come along to this arts lab. It's called the Oval House. And I went along, and that was it. I kind of walked through the doors one winter's evening, and it was the 60s, 68, 69. And it was the height of experimental theater, really. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, the days of La Mama and Grotowski and these exotic names that I knew nothing about.
Right.
But I did this workshop, and it was magic. Mm-hmm. It was just... And I was... It wasn't so much the workshop as it was the people. I found people that I could relate to for the first time in my life. Actors, artists, writers, young people like myself.
Did you have long hair?
I had long hair. I had an earring. I was one of the first guys to have earrings around my block anyway. And I had a goatee. And I thought I knew it all. And I was an exhibitionist, really. Suddenly this kind of shy, introverted lad became big and bold and began to fill the space around me.
Yeah. Did you want to be an actor or an American actor? Because I read that your nickname in one of these theater groups was Hollywood, that you had your eye on Hollywood from the get-go.
I've had two nicknames in my life. When I was at school in London, it was Irish. When I was at drama school in London, it was Hollywood. Well, I didn't grow up watching English plays. I grew up on movies. I grew up on American movies. And when I came to America, being an Irishman, I felt at home. I felt the greatest sense of liberation and freedom, and I could be anything. I didn't have the shaming aspect that happens when you're Irish and you're young, or Irish and old and living in England. It's gotten better. So, you know, I guess I wished and I wanted and I got what I wished for, really, and that is to come to America and to make movies.
I'm interested in what you just said about the shame of being Irish. I know, you were born outside of Dublin and came to live in England when you were still a young boy, about the age of 10 or 11, to live with your mother, who had separated from your father. Was there... Then did you have to sort of fight your way through playgrounds and through school because you were Irish in England?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, being a Paddy in 1964 with a thick Irish accent, you're going to come in for a hammering from the lads. And so it started with fists and it ended up with humor because I didn't like fighting. I hate fighting, you know. I have all the bravado of any guy, but at the end of the day, violence just mm-hmm. is nauseating and shocking in every sense of the word when it's real and it's happening to you. Mm. So I went to humor. I went to humor about myself and then humor about them without them knowing it. And kind of got by, survived, really. And then you kind of try to put all that in perspective and try to have, a balance to it. And where do you fit in? And I didn't fit in with the lads at my school when I was young. I made myself fit in and kind of dissembled in many ways. But it wasn't until I went to the Oval House Theatre Club and the company of actors and artists that I began to kind of breathe and just, you know, as I say, fill the space around me.
Did you learn to change your accent? Did you take, as a kid, take as much Irish out of you as you possibly could to survive?
I did, yes. I mean, and I've watched my own children do it when we went to America. And I think every child does. I mean, one wants to belong. We all want to fit in. There are those great people, though, who just stand outside the circle. And, you know, some of them are cool and enigmatic, and some of them are just strange and weird. But most of us want to belong. And I lost my Irish accent, you know, from talking like, you know, little lad. I remember my first day in school, the teacher said, okay, now I'm going to hand out the books and there's a letter and a number. Stand up and say the letter and the number. And I stood up and I said 30A. And the whole classroom laughed, completely just broke apart. And that was my first morning. And it was just terribly painful. So you develop this kind of Cockney accent. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't Cockney. And then, of course, you know, when I discovered theatre, they sounded completely different. Then you're with people who are educated and have refined accents. And then I try to sound like that kind of Englishman. And that was... So you kind of think, where do you place yourself?
Yeah. It sounds
and then
like...
you get to America, and then, you know, America was like... there was just a great acceptance and a wonderful sense of freedom.
Sounds like you've been acting a long time.
I have been acting a long time. Yeah. And I guess that's where it started. And I have analyzed it and looked at it and thought, But the Catholic Church certainly has something to do with it, too. And being an altar boy and dressing up in the old cassock and swinging the incense and all of that wonderful showmanship of the Catholic Church.
The sort of theater of it by then.
The theater of it. Right. Those were the first kind of performances of a young life, really. And there is all that theatricality, as we know, in the Catholic Church. Yeah. But I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, that kind of dissembling, trying to fit in, trying to disguise, trying to work, you then acquire a great psychology of people and of yourself. And once you get the hang of it, once you know that it's okay to do this, once you know that you're not a bad person and that you're not some kind of oddball, then you can have fun with it. Then, of course, you realize everyone else is doing it around you in their own subtle ways.
You have a new production company, Irish Dreamtime Production. Does that mean you've come back to embrace Ireland or the Irish in you?
You're possibly right. There is a kind of... because of... the pain that had happened there, I suppose, and you do think, oh, I've let the side down, I've let my Irishness go, and it has kind of gone full circle, and certainly with the naming of this company, Irish Dreamtime.
More with actor Pierce Brosnan after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to actor Pierce Brosnan. He's starring in the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair. You had mentioned the fact that The Thomas Crown Affair was fun. It's not a huge stretch for you. Are there certain directors that you would like to work with that you think would stretch you?
Yes, I'm sure there are out there. And I don't really have any names on paper. I mean, there are many men whose work I admire. Barry Levinson comes to mind, Martin Scorsese comes to mind, Pollock. The list is long, actually, in many respects. And You just have this wish or desire. Sometimes you don't even have to. It can be rather abstract. A longing, a want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll find it at some point.
You're not afraid of being typecast, or you feel like you still have room to develop and move?
Oh, I'm typecast. I've been typecast all my life. Most actors are, really. There's only, you know, great actors have three performances in them. And a good actor, I mean, most actors have one performance. They think they have many, but you look at their body of work and it's a repetition, it's a cloning. And I have a tiny bit of talent in my back pocket there, which I just polish and I keep working on and keep trying to define and find a comfort zone for myself. And every now and then you try and step outside of that and risk a little, and you either stand up or fall down. But I don't have any problems with the image or anything like this, or because then you get angry and then you get frustrated and then the joy goes out of it.
Yeah.
And I enjoy what I do so much, and I've been so lucky, and I want to keep it that way.
This is kind of a personal question, but it's a question I think that gets put to actors, especially, I don't want to use the word middle age anymore, but whether you would ever consider something like plastic surgery, whether you feel that in order to keep getting the kind of roles that you're getting, that you're going to have to keep yourself young.
Never
crossed your mind?
No, I don't like knives, needles, anything like that. If it hangs, it hangs. If it, you know, if the gray comes in and it's coming in, it's there's nothing. I'm not going to stop it. I mean, but plastic surgery, no, I don't think so. I think that's destroying yourself. Then I think you're doing yourself a disservice. Hopefully, I'll be true to this in another 15. Years, or
we'll play this tape back for
you'll
you.
You'll play this tape back and say, now just look at this photograph. This was 1999 when you were doing Thomas Crown, and now it's 2020. No, I've never thought about it. So far, the good old Irish jeans are wearing well for, you know, someone who's 46. And
do you think, though, that male actors have more leeway when it comes to how they look and how they get to age on film than female actors?
Oh, without question.
Yeah, the expectation is so different.
Sometimes the world of acting sits better on a man somehow than on a woman. Not that it's just you're always being judged as an actor constantly, and that's one of the first lessons of being an actor. You are going to be judged as soon as you put your foot on that stage. What's your entrance like? What is your performance? You're judged. And likewise in life. So guys can get away with it. You know, they can go out, they can... The madness of acting, they can get away with that madness, whether it be through the booze or their love affairs or anything like this. The women, on the other hand, you know, our society wants the woman to look perfect at all times, and they want the beauty and stuff like this. It's shallow, it's stupid, I know, but that's the way the movies have been set up and the way they've gone on for so many years. It's very difficult for women.
I know you've talked about this period in your life before when your wife died of ovarian cancer, got the diagnosis, and for several years you and she really lived with this this terrible cancer. And I wonder whether being an actor helped both of you through this period of your life. Or whether cancer is just too overwhelming to help you draw on some of those skills.
I don't think being actors really had much to do with it. I just think being the human beings we were and the people we were and the survivors we were, be it that she did not survive this terrible disease, she was a wonderful woman. She was very gracious and had the most wonderful sense of humor about herself and about life and an enjoyment of life. And the cup was always half full. And she had a lovely love of people and the world around her, an excitement about that, and a great laugh. And that got us through. I mean, and we never talked about dying because it was kind of abstract. And, you know, it didn't lead anywhere.
Yeah.
And she was alive, and there was always another doctor or another avenue of the cure being found. I mean, it was a real journey in the physical sense, the spiritual sense, of trying to stay alive over a period of 4 years and bring up children and keep the world alive for them. Hard, very hard, but so rewarding in many ways.
Really?
Yeah, well, just the sense of loss. I mean, of course, that is forever there, and it's with my children. I mean, to lose a mother at such young ages, the three children. But it just makes you appreciate life, you know, a deep appreciation of life and how fragile it is, and especially in the theatrical world that I live and the nonsense of Hollywood, you know, which I love. I'm not saying anything about it. I love the place, and but having gone through what my family and I have gone through, and many families go through, you do come out the other end if you have patience and just the courage to stand there and endure it, because there's nothing else you can do at times. Yeah. Just you sit with that pain. You just sit with it. There are rewards at the end, and glorious rewards. And like I say, the last 5 years for me have been magnificent. I've met a most wonderful woman, Keely Shea Smith. When I was looking the other way, least expecting it, and found love and found happiness and found family and found a harmony and found a wonderful foundation again from which to build and to grow from, and security.
And a new baby.
And a new bonny boy, Dylan. so life goes on. God, we're waxing lyrical here this morning now, aren't we? Jesus, Mary and Joseph, if they play this to the lads back in the old country, they'll know. They'll see right through it. What's he on, for God's sake? He must have been out on the binge last night now.
Well, I don't know where to go except to say thank you very much, Pierce Brosnan, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you very much, Marty.
Pierce Brosnan is starring in the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair. Here's Sting from the new soundtrack.
Pictures hanging in a hallway, and the fragment of this song, have remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, were you suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the color of her hair, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever spinning reel, as the images unwind, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your
coming up, a new documentary on Lenny Bruce. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
tonight on HBO, a documentary about controversial comedian Lenny Bruce has its premiere. TV critic David Bianculli has this review of Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth.
Lenny Bruce, after all these years, is still kind of a pop culture Rorschach test. His comic material and his basic biography haven't changed, but everyone who looks at it seems to get something different out of it. Even the reviews of Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, the HBO documentary premiering tonight, have been all over the place, with critics continuing to argue about what Lenny Bruce meant and means. Some people say he was the granddaddy of all raw comedy truth-tellers, before Richard Pryor, before Sam Kinison, before Chris Rock. Others say he never reached his comic potential and wasted his final years obsessed with hard drugs and ridiculous obscenity trials. Still others say that his material was outrageous then, but time has made it almost tame more than three decades after his 1966 death by drug overdose. As in any other Rorschach test, there's no right or wrong answer. All of those points are correct, but only partly. Yes, Lenny Bruce was way ahead of his time, but in some ways, he still is. The language he used then, and it was shocking, we hear all the time now in movies and on cable TV. But the topics he tackled, and the way he attacked them, remain as sensitive as they ever were. Could Lenny Bruce go on Letterman or Leno or Conan today and do Thank You, Mass Man or any of his bits about religion? No way. Yes, Bruce burned brightly and too briefly, and drugs played a big part of it. But at his peak, around 1963 and 1964, he was poetry and energy, prophet and social conscience. At his best, he was great. And if you listen to Lenny Bruce at length and what he had to say, you realize he was out there all alone, and in many ways, still is. Swear to Tell the Truth does an excellent job putting all this in context, especially in showing how what happened to Lenny Bruce offstage led directly to what he did onstage. In this clip, for example, we hear from Lenny's ex-wife, Honey, about the drugs and sex they did together, and from Lenny's mom, Sally Marr, about her opinion of her son's behavior. And in between the comments of those two women, we hear from Lenny himself, on stage, on the subject of sex.
The band used to come over to the house after work. We'd get loaded. One musician would end up bringing a girl with them, and then some other girls were going to come. And then pretty soon, it seemed like a lot of people were showing up at the house. People were drinking and using drugs. And then a little bit of far-out sex started getting in there. It was my first time at such a thing as this. There were four of us in the bed, and Lenny's laying next to me, and I had a football player, and he's got a stripper. And I just happened to look over at him, and the look of ecstasy on his face just freaked me out, because he looked just the same way he looked when we were making love. And that just triggered me. I said, oh, how can he feel the same way with some woman like that?
Guys can detach, and ladies can't. That's why they don't understand that guys are different. In other words, ladies are creatures of emotion, all one emotion. A lady can't go through a plate glass window and go to bed with you 10 seconds later. And they don't feel good. Really, endless. But guys can have head-on collisions with Greyhound buses, disaster areas. 50 people ain't dead on the highway, on the way to the hospital in the ambulance, the guy makes play for the nurse. She goes, how could you do a thing at a time like that? I got hot. Who got hot? How could he get hot? His foot was cut off. I got horny. I don't know. He's an animal. He got hot. That moron got hot. Well, I'm an animal. So I'm an animal.
I think the drugs had a lot to do with, because Honey went off and found other guys that she went with, you know? And Lenny went off and found other girls, but they still got together. So I always felt at that point that it's the drugs that's keeping him together.
Swear to Tell the Truth contains excerpts from Bruce's entire career, from his first shot on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts to his final drugged-out appearance on a Canadian TV interview show. The news footage and the interviews are as strong as the clips, and this definitely is a film worth watching. Ironically, though, not even this 90-minute documentary catches Lenny Bruce at his best. To do that, you have to go back to his original record albums, re-released on CD by Fantasy Records, and hear his act uncut. The problem in all of his court cases in the 60s is that the judges couldn't get past his language to hear what he had to say. In context, Lenny Bruce was honestly outrageous, and outrageously honest.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Lenny Bruce Swear to Tell the Truth premieres tonight on HBO. Later this week, we'll talk with documentary filmmaker Robert Wydy. Here's Lenny Bruce performing in San Francisco in 1958.
All the pictures used to motivate from Transylvania, and Boris Karloff narrates them. Oh, Bela, Bela, do you realize we haven't had a gig in 6 months? I don't know what it is, but we could work the Vegas, the loungers, better than the goofers, you know? I don't know what's coming of the industry, but soon the train will break down and Bela will be walking up looking for lodgings for the night. And we hear the knock on the door and the woman answering.
Mm-hmm. Who are you? I've never seen you before. You're a stranger in Transylvania. What is your name? Who are you?
Permit me to truth my tale. My name is Count Dracula.
Oh, you sound pretty wild. Come in, come in, come in. This town is the squarest. No one's come through here that's been far out for years.
Myself, my family are looking for lodgings for the night. And we don't want to be disturbed. Here's 10 years' rent in advance. Leave me alone. That's all. We want the room. Call it split. All right. Now I will take my family out of the boxes.
Oh, Papa, 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 it's so good to be out of the box. Papa, Papa.
Shut up and drink your blood. Bite Mama goodnight.
I can't stand to look at you. You.
But I don't bug me.
Don't give me bug me while the hip talk. Don't be bebop you.
Lenny Bruce in 1958. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Kathy Wolf, with Alan Tu and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Bob Purdick is our engineer. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Queen Mother's Century by Robert Lacey, a book of photographs in bookstores everywhere, and from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts, on the web at visx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From rural mental health to group therapy in New York City, on the next Fresh Air, we talk with psychologist Michael Roseman about helping farmers cope with the stress of keeping their farms intact. And journalist Paul Solotaroff tells us the story of one group in therapy. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.